Hujambo?
Sijambo sana.
Habari za leo?
Nzuri sana.
Habari za kazi?
Nzuri sana.
Habari za nyumbani?
Nzuri tu.
Sawa.
Naam.
Asante.
Asante.
That's a conversation in Swahili, one of the many languages spoken in Africa. I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.
It is estimated that there are approximately 2,000 languages spoken on the African continent, with possibly as many as 8,000 dialects. Most Americans, however, know very little about these languages and receive few opportunities to learn them. What are the most common African languages, and what are their unique features? How can we expand our understanding of Africa by knowing more about its rich linguistic traditions? Why is the U.S. government increasing its interest in promoting the teaching of African languages? Joining us to discuss African languages is Antonio Schleicher, professor of African languages and literature at the UW-Madison and the director of the National African Languages Resource Center. And we're also joined by Kiarie Wanjogu, professor of Swahili languages and cultures and the director of the program in African languages at Yale University here in Madison for a workshop on the teaching of Swahili.
Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you.
Thank you.
2,000 languages in Africa today. A couple of questions come to mind. One is, are any of those disappearing? Or is it going to be fewer than 2,000 languages in 50 years, do you suppose?
Actually, the issue of trying to preserve languages from dying is one of the activities that many linguistics departments in different parts of Africa are actually engaging in. They're really trying to make sure that these languages are recorded. So if you go as a student of linguistics to any of the linguistics department, one of the projects they're going to have you do is to reduce to writing an African language that's never been written before.
That was going to be my second question. So all of them by now probably have a written form, or most of them?
Not all, but there are quite a number of African languages that have a written form. Most of the African languages are oral, and so not all are written. But as my colleague said, there is now big pressure to put effort to preserve these languages. Yeah,
there are actually many of the languages that you can study up to the PhD level. For example, Swahili. If you are from Kenya or from Tanzania, you can study Swahili up to a PhD level. The same thing with Yoruba in Nigeria, Hausa in Nigeria, Igbo in Nigeria. So lots of these languages are, many of them are taught from grade school. Some will stop at grade school level. Some will be studied up to high school. But some of the major languages you can actually study up to a PhD level.
I'm guessing, based on my own lack of knowledge in this area, I'm guessing that you must run into a lot of people who are very surprised to hear how many languages there are. I mean, what are some of the most common misconceptions that you run into in your field?
The fact that maybe we speak one language in Africa.
African, right?
Yeah, we speak African. At least many Africans are multilingual. At least an African will be speaking two or three languages. And this is based on our colonial heritage. You will be speaking a colonial language, your mother tongue, and a national language in most cases. For example, in Kenya, we definitely speak at least three languages, English being the official language, Kiswahili national, and another mother tongue will be your third language.
If you travel from Kenya to, say, Angola, your best chance of being able to be understood would be to speak in a colonial language.
That's right, yeah. But Angola was colonized by the Portuguese, so chances are...
so you have to be a little more versatile
That's right. But English becomes really handy. Yeah, in that case, yeah.
For example, in Nigeria, because Nigeria is surrounded by Francophone countries, not only are we required to study English, which is the official language of Nigeria, we're also, in most schools, you are required to study French because they want us to be able to talk to our neighbors. Mm-hmm. So most typical Nigeria children will speak at least three languages.
Mm-hmm. How different do you think that makes it in terms of how one's dreams are, just how you sort of see the world if you do go so easily between, you know, three or four languages that way? What difference do you think it makes?
In terms of what?
I don't know, just how you, the perspective on the world.
Yeah, when I was still a graduate student, my colleagues were asking me what language I dream in. And It's, you know, I think our human brain is set up in a way that you can handle as many languages as you need, because you know you learn a language because you need it. Like right now, I'm set to speak in English, but if I meet a Swahili speaker, I'll tune to Kiswahili. If a Kikuyu speaker walks in here, we tune to Kikuyu, and you know we just move on. And unlike what some people tended to believe, it doesn't make your brain smaller, because there's someone who was arguing that if you learn many languages, then your brain becomes smaller and smaller.
I would think it would be the opposite, or at least more convoluted.
No, there are some people who argue that, if you learn many languages, you don't have any more room to learn biology or chemistry.
Well, I've seen some evidence of that later in life.
That's how it is, in that you are able to tune to the language that you need based on the environment. So it doesn't cause any confusion at all. In fact, what it does, multilingualism becomes a resource such that if, for example, I am speaking with my brother about a research that he's doing, chances are we'll be switching from one language to another depending on what we want to talk about. And therefore, language becomes, many languages becomes a resource that you go to pull idea. You know, it's like a bank where you can go and withdraw. Mm-hmm. And so we never run short of, words. And we never stop talking just because we don't have a word. We'll just go to that bank and pull a word in a different language as long as we understand. So we don't see it as a confusion. We see it as richness.
Yes.
Yeah.
And if you took a look at sort of the whole map of Africa and tried to sketch out language families, are there sort of regions where the Northern African countries speaking Arabic, or, just can you give sort of the overview of the major types of languages?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. If you move to the West African side, West Africa, the major languages there will be Yoruba, Hausa, Pular, Bamana, and Ewe, Fon. And those languages, some of them are, or Akan in Ghana, some of them are related, but the relationship may be just the kind of relationship you will find between French and Italian. Of French and Portuguese.
Not mutually intelligible.
Mm-hmm. They are still separate languages, but they originated from the same, what we call proto-language. Mm-hmm. Then if you move to the eastern part, starting from the southeastern part of Nigeria to the eastern part, Central Africa, and to South Africa, you get a lot of languages that we call Bantu languages. And those are, if you learn one Bantu language, it's a lot easier for you to learn another Bantu language. They are still not mutually intelligible, but at least they are close enough because they come from the same proto-language. But within that, like if you move, some parts of Southern Africa too, there are languages we call the Nilo-Saharan languages, the languages with cliques. Mm-hmm. Croissant languages. So those are not even related at all to the Bantu languages. So African languages are kind of divided into like four major huge language families. Then Arabic, in a way, is kind of, different, because it's almost like maybe what we can call a colonial language, also like English and French. Because if you go to North Africa, they actually have their own local languages like Berber, Tamarash. They have their own local languages before Arabic, mm-hmm. Came over. And some of those languages are kind of almost like still there, but not as predominant anymore because of the predominance of Arabic in the northern part. But in the West, East, and South, you still have all the major big African languages.
How did English become a major language in Africa?
English has colonies. Nigeria was a colony.
Nigeria?
Yeah. Oh, Nigeria, and so, Ghana, mm-hmm. Gambia.
All of those were colonized by the English.
Oh, mm-hmm. yeah. That's mm-hmm. why we have English there now.
Kenya
also.
Would you say that English would come, based on what you've said so far, mm-hmm. that English would come closest to lingua franca for Africa? In other words, the most people would understand that, or if not, what would be the language that most people would understand?
If you read literature, especially if you read work by Bukamba, there is a misconception. The fact that we were colonized by the British doesn't mean that a majority of the people are fluent in English. You know, you can only go up to a certain extent. People do not learn that language to reach high mastery level, but they will be able to understand maybe very, very basic English because other African languages are still very, very dominant. People still feel connected with those languages, local languages, so that you find, like in the Kenyan case, English is restricted to schools. So, the government declared English the official language, but people use other languages. You go to the market, people are using Swahili and other local languages.
That's so common in many countries, isn't it?
And so when you designate a language, a national language, you would expect that a majority of the people will be fluent in it, but that's not the case in many African languages. Actually, Bokamba puts the percentage of people who would claim fluency in those colonial languages to between 16 and 24%. And so you can see that number is quite low. Mm-hmm. But you bring in these other languages and people can handle them. The only problem is that those languages have not been empowered to enable these people to carry on more complicated stuff in it. So what I mean here is, you'd expect that these are the languages of trade, for example.
Sure.
But they are not. They are just restricted to very, very basic marketplace communication. People of different linguistic backgrounds would use Swahili, for example. Only in Tanzania would we say that Kiswahili has gained higher prominence because it's the language of instruction in the primary school, that is like first through eighth grade.
And when you say Kiswahili, that is a particular form or region for Swahili, or what's the difference there?
Between what?
Kiswahili and what we call Swahili.
It's the same thing. It's the same thing. It's just that when we say it as a language, the key is usually the language marker. So if I wanted to say English, I'll say Kiingereza. If you want to say Chinese, I say Kichina, Kijapani, Kifaransa, Kirusi. So the key is the language marker.
It's the difference between saying French and Francais.
Okay.
Let's say there is a conference, a pan-African conference, a meeting of people from many different African countries around a theme, how is language handled? Because I would think it would really obstruct unity or, you know, partnerships if you've got so many different language barriers.
If normally you have a conference, for example, it will probably be a conference that's attended by educated people. Usually, English is taught in school, so it's only spoken by educated people. If you don't go to school, you don't speak English, or you may pick what we call pidgin English, on the way. But it's mostly educated people that use English. So if you have like a national conference, chances are they'll use English. But if it is Pan-African conference, they may decide to also use French. They could say you could give your presentation in French because of the francophonies that will be at the conference. So usually they just use the official languages. Though with our African Union now, we have African Union that also has now declared Swahili as one of the languages that they can use. Mm-hmm. And now also, funny enough, like in Nigeria, many of the House of Representatives are also adopting local languages in their deliberations. They will use English and then set aside a day when they will do their deliberation in a major language of the region, of the state. So that's usually how we've been functioning in Nigeria. The beauty of being an African is that it's amazing the way we function in two worlds. The European world and also the African world. Yeah. And we kind of switch back and forth, depending on the topic.
Mm-hmm. As we get into more and more global commerce, you see more and more of that, don't you? You see the language of trade, whether it's English or Chinese or whatever it will be. And then, of course, the more regional languages that people would use at home.
I mean, talking about, you just mentioned globalization, which is kind of becoming a scary, a term for us now. Because
for a lot of
people, the effect it's having now is that many Africans are not paying attention to their local languages anymore because they feel English, is the global language, or from the French-speaking countries, French is the global language. It's the language of power. Is the language of technology. And as a result, even many Africans, even in Africa, will refuse to teach their children African languages.
Really?
But what is going on now, because of the interest of American government, as you said, now encouraging Americans to study African languages, and the fact that we are now, you know, people like us who teach American students, we have opportunity to take American students to Africa to study more. So when Africans now see Europeans and Americans learning their languages, they are like, uh-oh, so our languages are important. So it's kind of like a pendulum. It's now swinging back.
And how do you explain to someone who says, okay, you've got so many different languages, why is it important to preserve a particular language? You know, if, how do you make that case? What is special about each one?
Culture. Mm-hmm. Your culture, because your language is who you are. Your language, you know, kind of encompasses your culture, the way you view the world, the way you see the world. So it's like when your language is taken away from you, a big part of you is gone. So that's why, you know, now even in different African countries, they're saying, you know, you don't want to lose your language, because your language, it really, you know, defines you. That, and that's why people are now trying, making a lot of effort to preserve their language. I can tell you, when I was in grade school, you know, several years ago, before, because of the vogue that you have to speak English, act like Europeans, people will not dress like I'm dressing now or like he's dressing to school, because, no, you need to act like Europeans. But now, if you go to Nigeria, everybody's wearing this kind of thing, the clothing that I'm wearing.
Well, some people over here, too, for that matter,
right,
who have no African
roots.
That's
right. Because people are now saying, I want to be who I am. I don't want to be somebody else. You know, I can never really be European. I've been here now for, you know, 30 years, and yet I still want to retain my accent, because I still want to define myself as a Nigerian. Because, you know, there is a part of you that is just there that you can't deny. And if you let go your language, then it's like one researcher said, you will find yourself becoming somebody of two worlds, but citizen of none.
Sure, citizen of neither one.
Neither one.
Was there no great reaction against the colonial languages when colonialism ended in Africa? I mean, this, and we're talking about the 1950s for many parts of Africa, but there seems, the way you're describing it, not to have been a movement to, well, let's forget those languages, the French and others, and concentrate just on our local languages. It was always a push toward the Europeanizing of language.
It depends on who took over after the colonialists left.
Right.
The people who took over leadership were trained by the colonizers to continue, you know, to maintain the status quo. The education system was foreign, and they felt that that was the best way forward. And so it was not possible for them to change. That's what they knew best. In fact, the push to switching back now to even local languages is a very, very recent development that people have started now thinking. I think we, as my colleague mentioned, that we are losing quite a lot. Because you see, language, the way it is connected to culture, is also connected to the way we perceive and interpret our environment, our setting. And when you remove that, then we stop seeing, we stop interpreting our environment. We have to see it from another person's eye. And that becomes very, very difficult. And so when you take that, you're also losing a lot of knowledge. Take, for example, Americans use a lot of Chinese medicine. Sometimes this medicine come with Chinese names. If you take that language off, then what will they be calling that medicine? That's gone. And so it's very, very important to understand that the way we perceive the world and the way we interpret it is very, very tied to our languages and our brains. And that's becoming like a new thing that people are realizing. And so we are switching back to that. But if you look at Kenya, for example, our language, especially our language policy, is a good one if you read it on paper, because we say that we should be teaching our children in the mother tongue in the first three years. But practically, that's not what happens because of what she said. We know we have not empowered our languages so that there is a need or the demand for them. So what do people ask when you go to ask for, I mean, when you're looking for employment? They ask your proficiency in English. So why waste time teaching these kids in the mother tongue? Mm-hmm. So that's a problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, there are some concepts that don't translate, I assume, from your native language to English or any other language. What would be some examples from Kenya and from Nigeria from your experience that if you lost that language, you wouldn't be able to communicate that concept very well?
Oh, for example, when you walked in here, I was supposed to greet you by saying "Shikamo," showing a lot of respect to you because you are my senior. But English doesn't give me that power to say "Shikamo."
We're not too big on that senior.
I can't say hi to you. It's very disrespectful. So you see,
I'm going to write that down. See if we can inculcate that a little bit.
Yeah, yes. You know, so there is a lot. Even the fact that. Since you're senior than me, you're not supposed to initiate greeting to me. I'm supposed to initiate it.
I'll remember that for next time, too.
That's a good example of how language reflects culture and tradition.
What about from Nigeria?
And also, in Yoruba, our language expresses the notion of community as opposed to individualism. If I lose Yoruba, the sense of community will be gone for me. For example, Yoruba doesn't have a word for cousin, doesn't have a word for uncle. My uncle is my older father or my younger father. Mm-hmm. My aunt, we don't have a word for aunt because my auntie is my older mother or my older or my younger mother. Yeah. So it's like a communal, you know, my cousins are all my brothers and sisters. Even in English, we kind of like, we will see our cousin, I will say, this is my brother, because I can't say my cousin.
That's interesting, because, you know, I've run into that same phenomenon with Chinese, where they don't refer to a cousin, they refer to my brother. I thought, I didn't know you had a brother.
Exactly. Yeah. And an American will ask me, is he really from your mother and your father? And I say, you don't get it. He's my brother, because, and another thing is, if he's Yoruba and we're very close, automatically now he becomes my brother, which is kind of foreign, you know, to an American or most European. So that's why that language, you know, keeps that. You know, like people will come, younger Nigerians will come here. If they are old enough to be my daughter or my son, immediately they will call me mother. Because now it's now my responsibility to take care of them like I would take care of my own children, you know, and you see all that in the language that
so
we use.
So you see, the example she gave is exactly the same in East Africa. In Swahili, the aunties are from your father's side, okay? Your uncles are from your mother's side because the brothers to your dad are your father, too.
And you wouldn't probably try to translate that into English if you were in this country.
There are a lot of examples. Even a simple thing like when it comes time for us to leave, in English you'll say, we'll see you. Yes. Kiswahili doesn't allow us to say that. We say, we'll see each other.
Nice.
Because how can you see me and I'm not seeing you?
There is a joke where you say, I'll see you, and the response is, not if I see you first.
Also, when you meet a Yoruba or even an African, you like what we did, you see them, the first thing you want to say, how are you? How is your family? How is your, you know, your sibling, how is, just in the greeting, before you even go to any topic. Whereas an American would just say, if they even say hi. To us, it's like, they don't care. It's, you know, they don't care.
Maybe they don't.
Exactly. It's difficult to translate that into, you know, another language. I also wanted, actually, you were talking about why, the issue of why we couldn't push some of the local languages to take over, maybe like English or Yoruba. It's also because most African countries are multilingual. So which language do you choose without going into warfare? Like Nigeria has about 450 languages. And trying to choose one language above the other, it's going to cause a civil war.
Boy, I thought they had problems in Canada. They just have two languages.
I mean, before, if national news will be read in 12 major Nigerian languages. Yes.
You won't have time for a lot of news that
way. That's right. That's right, for, you know, national news. So, and we have major ones, like Yoruba is spoken by about 30 million people, Hausa about also maybe about 35 million, Igbo about 20 million, but you can't choose Hausa over Yoruba or Igbo. So now the language that everybody feels, well, okay, we can use is English at school. The other issue is economy. you know, for us to be able to even use any of this language in a way, you know, to discuss all this technology and all these modern things, we have to develop the language, also develop materials to teach these languages in school. And most African countries don't have the money to be able to do that.
We're going to delve more into Swahili and Yoruba and other languages when we continue in a moment with University of the Air.
Support for WPR comes from the Bayfield Chamber and Visitors Bureau, offering information about fall getaways to Bayfield during the Bounty of Fall celebration. Feasts for the taste buds and feasts for the eyes. Fall getaway package information at bayfield.org.
Waandishi wa vitabu wa Afrika Mashariki. Katika nchi za Afrika Mashariki, kuna waandishi wengi na tena maarufu katika kuandika vitabu. Waandishi hawa wameandika vitabu vya riwaya, ushairi, tamthilia, siasa, uchumi na utamaduni. Nchini Tanzania, kuna waandishi wengi na baadhi yao ni Penina Mlama katika kitabu cha Nguzo Mama. Aliongelea kuhusu ukombozi wa wanawake na jinsi wanaume wanavyoweza kusaidiana na wanawake kufikia malengo waliyoyaweka. Naye Shafi Adam Shafi katika kitabu chake cha Kuli aliongelea masuala ya wafanyakazi, mojawapo ilikuwa ni kazi, ni haki za wafanyakazi. Mwandishi mwingine ni Kezila Habi katika kitabu chake Gamba la Nyoka, anaongelea kuhusu masuala ya kijamii na kisiasa. Kwa mfano, anaongelea jinsi matatizo yanavyokumba Tanzania baada ya kupata uhuru, ambapo wanasiasa walikuwa walafi kwa kujichukulia vitu na kwa manufaa yao wenyewe. Aliongelea pia swala la jinsia, ushairi, athari za ukoloni. Pia katika kitabu cha Rosa Mystica kinaongelea masuala mengi katika lakini lilojitokeza sana ni swala la jinsia. Kuna mwandishi mwingine mashuhuri ambaye kwa sasa ni marehemu, lakini anakumbukwa sana kwa ustadi wake katika kuandika mashairi riwaya. Huyo si mwingine bali ni Shaban Robert. Yeye aliandika vitabu vingi, kimojawapo kikiwa ni Kusadikika na Kufikirika.
That's a passage from a textbook in Swahili. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guests are Kiarie Wangjogu from Yale University and Antonia Schleicher from here at the UW-Madison. We're talking about African languages. So tell me about that passage in Swahili. I got the word Tanzania, but that's
right.
About it. What were you saying, and what can we learn about the Swahili language from the sound of it and how it's put together? What's unique about it?
Yeah, the passage is about authors of East Africa. So there are a few authors that have been identified. One of them is a lady by the name of Penina Mlama. Actually, I knew her as Mrando. I mean, the passage talks about a book that she writes here about, and the book's theme is about the rights of women. And then there is another book by Shafi Adam Shafi, Shafi Adam Shafi from Tanzania, who also has a book by the title of Kuli. And the book talks about how Tanzanian political system changed after independence, that people started becoming greedy and taking, you know, national resources to enrich themselves. And also the passage talks about another author by the name of Kezila Habi, and they cite two books, one Rosa Mystica and Gamba la Nyoka, which also follows up the theme of individualism by politicians. And the passage also finalizes by identifying one of the key authors actually known in the Swahili world by the name of Shaban Robert, who actually published about 16 books in prose, poetry, and plays.
And yeah. What's unique about the sentence structure? You know how, like in German, the verbs are often at the end, or there's these sort of large compound words with capital letters. You know, each language has its sort of unique syntax, its unique way of putting words together. The way Swahili is used in the passage you just read, what's unique about it?
It follows the same, almost same word order of the subject, verb, object. But the interesting thing is that most of the things that change in Kiswahili, the change occurs in the verb. And so if you want to indicate a prepositional form or a causative form, they all happen in the verb. The other quality in Swahili that English doesn't have is the power of inserting what we call object markers. Let's say, for example, if I want to say it like, I love you, if I want to tell her I love you, I can say that in one word in Kiswahili, ninakupenda. and where the ni will be the subject, that na is the tense, and ku is the object for her.
And it's all one word.
It's one word, yeah. And the other thing is, almost all words in Kiswahili, as long as they are not borrowed, they end in vowels. So the syllable combination is consonant, vowel, all, consonant, vowel, consonant, consonant, vowel. So we must end in a vowel. If we borrow a word, we'll make it end in a vowel.
That kind of provides, it seems to me, a kind of a musical quality continuity of the words. It almost sounds like, you know, flowing water.
And there were some parts you read very rapidly. I don't know, almost, you know, like the syllables come very quickly. Yeah. But it has a sort of a music.
Maybe it's because of I'm familiar with these works. Maybe so if I saw, like, when they mentioned somebody like Kezilahabi, so I was, I could tell straight that Kezilahabi has written a book that I am familiar with, you know, Rosa Mystica, Gambala Nyoka, Kichwa Maji, and so many others. So I could, you know, easily predict what maybe they are going to write about.
Swahili is one of the African languages that actually has the longest, one of the longer written histories, is that right?
We can say that, yeah. It has a very long literary history because first it came in contact with Arabic. Swahili was written in Arabic first before the Roman alphabet was introduced to it. And so you get some of the old Swahili poetry written in Arabic.
So this would be what, 18th century?
I think it is even earlier. It's earlier than
but,
that.
Three, four hundred years back.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's a version of Swahili both in Arabic and with the Roman.
Some old poems would come.
And with the Roman alphabet, is it done sort of in a phonetic way then, sort of trying to capture the sound?
Yes.
But what about intonation? I know in some languages, you know, just the way you raise your voice for a question is not there in others. When we had a Korean student living with, when she would be on the phone, it would sound as if she hung up on someone because it didn't have the same ending sound that we have. But what about in Swahili? Do you raise your voice in a different way?
Only when it is a question. It is not tonal.
Okay.
Only when it is a question. Yeah.
And it's the same raising voices as in English, pretty much the same kind of thing.
Are there tonal African languages?
Oh, yeah.
Yoruba is. Swahili always is a stress language, but the stress is always
penultimate
syllable. Second to the last
syllable.
Always
second to the last. That's quite
usual. Can you read one sentence sort of slowly that shows that then? That shows those vowels at the end and the way the stresses work.
Okay, let me see. Tanzania, it will
Tanzania.
Be.
Tanzania.
Yeah. That, yeah.
And that would be true of loan words too? Swahili would automatically use, so it would be, let's see, Emily. Instead of Emily.
And, but you see, Emily is easy because you see Y is it's a semi-vowel. And so...
But somebody's name who doesn't end in a vowel,
We'll put a vowel. Oh. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we'll put a vowel.
I mean, like a word that says anakum.
Anakumbukwa.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anakumbukwa.
Bukwa.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Wandishi.
Yeah.
Wandishi.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or even Swahili itself.
So that would be the same then for all the given names, too, then would all have the accent on that same syllable.
Penultimate syllable,
It's a unique feature of Swahili.
Do you think, any thought on the origin of that? Did it come out of a kind of singing or a
I don't know, but most of the Bantu languages are rhythmical. Yeah, even my students tell me that sometimes when they are saying a sentence, it's like a song. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wish I had time to get a poem and read a poem for you. It's very nice. It's just like a song.
Well, the funny thing though about Swahili is that Swahili, the standard Swahili, is the only really a Bantu language that is no longer tonal. Mm-hmm. And I think it's as a result of the influence from Arabic, English, because Swahili has a huge borrowing from Arabic. Even the word Swahili itself is from Arabic. Sahel.
Would you say the Swahili is probably the African language most spoken by non-Africans?
Yes. Mm-hmm. It's the most, is the language that is used most by second language speakers. Actually, native speakers of Swahili are very few.
Very few.
But native speakers of Yoruba are more. But there are many more people. Like, he's not a native speaker of Swahili, but he's a second it a second language.
Mm-hmm. And which countries in Africa would you say you would find the most use of Swahili?
Tanzania.
And what other countries?
We can say Kiswahili covered Tanzania, Kenya, parts of Uganda also, Rwanda, Burundi, Congo. One factor that helped in the development of Kiswahili in Tanzania more than any other place is political. Because, you know, Tanzania was colonized by the Germans before the First World War. And the Germans didn't want Tanzanians to learn German. Mm. So they opted to learn their language to rule over them.
They didn't want them to learn German. That's interesting.
No, they did not.
The politics
they said,
of that.
They said German is... it's a language of superior people.
That would have been my guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So they learned Swahili to govern over Tanzanians. And so once the Germans lost in the First World War and Tanzania was taken over by the British, Kiswahili had spread so much so that the British could not change that. So they continued with the same. They introduced English, but Kiswahili had gained a lot of roots. Not to forget that the Arabs were there before, and the Arabs had spread Kiswahili to the interior through trade. Yeah, Zanzibar, which is one of the major islands at the coast of Tanzania, part of Tanzania actually, was a major trade center. And most of the goods that would come from the interior would be exported through that area.
Through Zanzibar.
And these trade caravans used to, helped a lot in the spread of Kiswahili. So Kame independence and Kiswahili is widespread, unlike in Kenya, where colonialism did not change hands. We were colonized by the British from the beginning. And so that's the difference that we get. In Uganda, the history is different. Because in Uganda, Kiswahili was used as oppressive language. It was the language of the military, the police. And so people resented Kiswahili in Uganda until now that Museveni has tried to bring it back. It is now an examinable subject from fourth grade in Uganda. In Kenya also, our government did not put a lot of effort in the development of Kiswahili. It was declared the national language in 1969, language of parliament in 1974. But the government did not invest in its development. It's not like in Tanzania where they had a Kiswahili council, BAKITA, Baraza la Kiswahili. And then, the government set aside a lot of money to development of Kiswahili. Even the first president set an example by translating some of the Shakespeare's books in Kiswahili. Mm-hmm. I read...
Nice to know what that would sound like.
Julius Caesar in Kiswahili. Julius Caesari in Kiswahili. I read The Merchants of Venice in Kiswahili. Mabepari wa Venice. Translated by Nyerere.
So if you were to say to be or not to be in Swahili, how would it come out?
You see, when you translate expressions, they don't come out nicely. Yeah, kusema kuwa ama kutokuwa, then,
Yeah. It still sounds musical. What would be the main influences on Swahili? You mentioned Arabic. Other languages that have large influence on Swahili?
English and Portuguese.
Yeah. So it's quite an interesting combination. Yeah.
And are there any words out of Swahili that have found their way into English?
Yeah. Maybe. Safari.
Safari. Okay.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
Which has that pattern, the stress and the vowel at the end.
Yeah.
Okay.
You wonder whether it's from Arabic, because it's also an Arabic word.
Is it? Right. Yeah. So when these things flow back and forth,
it can be hard to tell. Arabic to Swahili to English. Yeah.
We're going to sample Yoruba in a moment with University of the Air.
Support for WPR comes from Peninsula Players celebrating 75 years of live theater in Door County, presenting Alan Ackbourn's sci-fi comedy Comic Potential through September 5th. Can acting robots take over TV? Information at peninsulaplayers.com.
Ore oti to sowon ojulari ore nbe laye afuni ni woje ore awon bi aran ni lowo ore ni ko to nkan bi arire ba ni je ore aje atekun boya ni ko ni dija nibi ihuwasi lati modale won a fi juju boju ore won lekun ore nde o le si ore le pani ore le lani.
Well, it sounds very nice, and I can't wait to find out what it means in English. The voice belongs to Antonia Schleicher of Nigeria, and that is one of the Nigerian languages, Yoruba, which we will be talking about for the balance of this hour. Also with us for University of the Air is Kyrie Wanjogu of Kenya. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Air. And I think I can say with some confidence, having heard some Swahili earlier in the hour, that I could distinguish that those were two different languages. There is a different quality. What was the content there? What were you saying?
It's saying that the title of the poem is "Our Faithful Friends Are Rare." That is, friends full of lip service exist in the world. That the friends that give a hook to friends to swallow are not, you know, rare. Friends that help you are very few. Just like people who enjoy good fortune with you. And it says, won't friendship between a dog and a leopard result in a fight? Through their attitude, you will know who a traitor is. They'll use confusion to cover up, to make their friends cry. Friends set a trap for their friends by sending a robber to their friends. Friends can kill, but at the same time, friends can save.
Well, it's not as sweet as it sounded.
There's a lot of bad friends out there.
Yeah, that seems to be the bottom line there.
But in Yoruba, it sounded very different. Tell us about the language itself, its syntax, its patterns and things.
The beauty of Yoruba is that it's tonal. I'm not sure if you get the musical part of it. If you change the way tones work, they work like consonants and vowels. If you change one tone to the other, you change the meaning. For example, mm-hmm. If I say igba, 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 I've said four things.
Oh, boy.
By just
also like Chinese.
Like Chinese, yeah. That's right.
So what four things have you
igba,
just...
Igba, calabash. Igba, it's like a kind of fruit. We call it garden fruit. Igba is 200. Igba is time.
Goodness.
Does that allow for some nice puns in Yoruba?
Yes.
Some double meanings.
Yes.
And I would assume little toddlers learning the language must, stumble over the wrong ones as they're
and Americans also learning
Yoruba. Yes, I'm sure.
Sure, they say hilarious things.
Because they could say, "I want to deliver a baby," or "I'm throwing up." Just by using one word, B or B. You know, it's that really tones are so unique and critical in the language that, but it's something that you learn in context also as you learn the sentences. And Yoruba kind of syntax is actually very simple. It's, unlike Swahili, where, that we call agglutinating. Almost Swahili is like a puzzle. You put all those together and you can actually know where one word ends. Yoruba is almost like isolating, almost close to Chinese also, where one word means one thing. And it's also inflectional because you can have prefix, coming up with the root. So it's a combination of isolating and inflection.
So technical question, how does a foreigner reading, and I assume you were talking about a Roman alphabet here, Yoruba, how do you indicate the difference between one tone and another that's so crucial?
We mark the tones.
Just a different mark over each word.
We use the grave accent for low tone, acute accent for high tone. Absence of tone is mid tone because Yoruba has three level tones.
And are there some things that are hard to translate? Just the way Kyaria was saying that it's hard for him to say hi in a respectful way to a senior using just the English hi. Are there concepts that are embedded in certain words in Yoruba that you can't really translate?
I'm married to an American and he always gets a big kick out of my trying to translate a proverb. From Yoruba to English. There is a Yoruba proverb that says, Atokere ni oloju jijiti mekunsun, which means make hay before,
make hay while the sun shines.
While the sun shines. Uh-huh. That's the kind of close.
Mm-hmm.
But if you translate it literally, it says it is, while if you're meeting somebody who has sunken eye,
if they want to know, if they want you to know that they are crying, they have to start the cry long before they come to you.
That's how you translate make well, hey, well, the sunshine.
Exactly.
Raise an interesting question. And I wonder, I mean, it's part culture and part just linguistic, but if you get into something like trying to translate the Bible, I mean, I've heard, for example, that if you talk about sheep in some cultures, which is a biblical device, you know, that it means something very different, or it would create the wrong impression. If you run into things that just create really are difficult that way when you're trying to translate them into English?
Yes. I mean, actually, you mentioned a good example, especially with Bible translation, when the cultural information, especially when maybe you're translating the Old Testament with the Jewish culture, that may be completely, you know, different, or even concepts that don't even exist at all in our own culture. Usually what they try to do either coin a word, if they first of all try to understand the concept, either coin a word or borrow the word, you know, like literally.
Sure.
Like snow. Bible says your sins will be white as snow. I mean, I've never seen snow in my life until I came here. So what do we say? We say sino. So we just borrow the word. So languages do that a lot. When a cultural group comes in contact with another culture and they borrow a cultural concept, they can either coin a word, a new word, you know, for that, or they could just maybe borrow it. Television is a good one. When we, you know, television, we didn't, it was an object that was borrowed from European. So what we did was we first of all said television. But then later we coined a word that says television is a machine that taps your voice and your image.
Can you give us a sentence in Yoruba and sort of show us how that, like one sentence would work, how it would sound?
A sentence, let me see. For example, Egbe agbabolu orileide ti orileide Nigeria ti o ti wa ni imurasile fun idije yo doju ko awon akegbe won lati orileide Kenya. The structure is like what we call subject, verb, object. So, but we also have the kind of split verb system like German, where one part of the verb will begin before the object, and then the second part of the verb will be at the end of the sentence. So when I was learning German, it was very easy for me to locate the split verbs because it's very common. It's very common in Yoruba. We call them we also have in Yoruba, we also have what we call serial verb construction, where you could have three verbs just one after the other.
Oh, that's exciting for a powerful sentence.
So unlike, you know, English, we will just have one verb, you know, following one the other. We call it serial verb instruction.
You mean actually three completely different verbs, not helping verbs, but three completely
different? No, three different verbs.
So how would something like that translate? I mean, how could you get that concept across? I'm trying to figure out how that would work.
If you say molo mura jeun, like I went, I prepared, and eat.
Okay, yeah, so you wouldn't bother to repeat the subject.
Right.
You would just say,
I
went, prepared, ate.
Yeah.
Well, that's compact.
So all those verbs will be there.
Both of you are at centers for African languages. Briefly, what would you say is the purpose of these centers for African languages and sort of your mission or whatever? You know, final thoughts on why people should learn these languages.
The center that I direct here at the University of Wisconsin, which is called the National African Language Resource Center, is actually funded by the federal government, the Department of Education. And the main purpose is to be able to promote African languages in the U.S. in terms of just even bringing awareness, you know, like saying, hey, Africa is not just about one language, it's about almost 2,000 languages. So we are expected to develop materials, like all these Swahili materials were developed. Then we also kind of, you know, do a lot of
professional development like we're doing now for Swahili teachers all over the nation who apply to come. So we try to train instructors how to teach the languages so that they can teach very well and the American students can learn the language better. So we do a lot of professional development for African language instructors all over, any language, Acholi, Swahili, Yoruba, Hausa, any language that is being taught. We teach like about maybe 29 African languages in this country, you know, from at different universities. Then we also develop, we try to develop materials for those languages so that they will be available for Americans to learn. Then we also provide interpreters, like if the government or any agency needs a translators or interpreters or court system, they can call our office and then we have a resource list that we will give them information about who they can contact to help them. So it's basically a resource center for anybody who wants to know anything about African languages.
And of course, we all link with the National Resource Center in our respective institutional centers. But there are other things we could mention here. For example, the issue of opening Africa for research. You know, we find that someone may be interested to do research in Africa and they go there, they don't have language background and the research fails. And so we serve those people who are also, you know, doing research in Africa. And also, as my colleague mentioned about, you know, exposing Americans to other world languages so that they can communicate with other people, relate with them, and even appreciate. I have found that students who have taken Kiswahili for 2 years, even from the first year, they start behaving differently. You know, so and you can see them changing. I was very impressed, for example, by a student who picked one proverb and used Swahili proverb and used it to fundraise to support her own project in Kenya. So we were just talking, and then I mentioned something, haba na haba, hujaza kibaba, which means little by little you feel the tin. I didn't know she took that. And so a week later, she showed up with the T-shirts with Haba na Haba, which has a kibaba. And she was selling these T-shirts. And so that shows appreciation of, and every time now, appreciation of other people's culture. And, you know, every time now they ask me, do you have a proverb for this? Because most of the time, we use proverbs a lot. Instead of telling stories, we give proverbs. But to go back to what, because I can easily digress, we teach these languages as part of other foreign languages. Just the way students would take German, French, Spanish, etc., we also offer African languages to meet that need, and mostly for research purposes. Even sometimes students just come to try new things. You know, the first day of class, we ask them, why did you choose to take Swahili? Why did you decide to take Yoruba? Why did you decide to take Twi? And they say, you know, I just want to try something new. And
so we are there for that.
Yeah, you just want to try something. Then they end up liking it.
Our guests this hour have been Kia Rie Onjogu and Antonia Schleicher, and it's been very, very interesting. Thanks for being with us.
Yeah, thank you very much for having us.
Thank you.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach. I hope you can join us for the next hour of University of the Year. Join us next Sunday afternoon at 4 for University of the Year as we look into the career of George Edwin Taylor, his historic run for the White House in 1904, and the making of independent black politics in America. That's next Sunday afternoon right here on Wisconsin Public Radio.